Hello and welcome to This Is Property with John Pigeon and Emily Wallace. Today we are answering all your questions. We've got some beauties today. What are the steps when upgrading your principal place of residence? We're critiquing different strategies with granny flats out the back, etc. We're talking about termites and how much of a pest they are, capital gains tax and the six-year rule, the downsides of pulling equity out if there is any. Emily, we've got a truckload to answer. I don't know if we're going to get through them all, but we'll do our best. Let's get into things.
Let's do it.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
All right, so Scott says, what are the steps when upgrading your principal place of residence? If the plan is to sell your current home to move into a bigger slash more expensive one, how does the finance work? If the bank will only lend you $300,000, you have a house worth $500,000 and want to buy a place worth $800,000. What happens if your house doesn't sell? Where do you live while all this is happening? What is the general process? Ooh, a few different parts to this, isn't
there? Yes, there's a lot. Let's start with the finance, maybe.
Yes. Well, so if you're planning on selling that home that you've got, there's two ways you can go about it to upgrade to another home. You can sell the property before you buy your upgrader, or you can sell the property after the upgrader. And I think we've spoken about this numerous times, Emily. There is a risk in selling this property after you buy your upgraded home, and it's you're getting something called bridging finance, where the bank will say, look, we know what your property is worth that you're about to sell. We know you're going to sell it. We know what the property is worth that you're going to buy. Okay, we'll give you bridging finance, and you've got, let's say, 6 months to get that done.
Yeah. Yeah,
I think I've mentioned on the show previously, or at least on the main show, a good friend of mine went through this process and it was an absolute nightmare for him because the market changed and couldn't sell the property that he was wanting to sell to upgrade. He got the upgraded home, living in the upgraded home, but still couldn't sell that previous property. So he was up for a lot more expenses than he wished for, knowing that that 6 month period did expire and the banks continue to charge on a monthly basis their amount. Right now, it does depend on the debt difference that you are going to basically have be secured for from the bank. But in his situation, it was around about $20,000 a month.
Gosh, ouch.
So, Scott, that's not to scare you, but it kind of is to say, well, if it was me and I was recommending what to do for other people, I would definitely be saying sell the property first, and then you know you've got cash in the bank, you've got a cash deposit to hand down, you know what you can lend, you know what the property is worth, you're not rushed or forced into taking an offer that you don't want, and away you go. Right. Now, some people might be thinking, why didn't you tell your friend this? Well, my friend did it before asking me. So after the fact, he's come and said, this is what I've done. I'm like, mate, you need to speak up. But any case, Emily, any further thoughts to that?
Yeah, look, it's a really common scenario for upsizers, typically going from, you know, a two-bedroom apartment or villa unit into a three or four-bed townhouse or house. And there's a couple of ways about it in terms of, I agree with you, definitely sell before you buy. You know what money you've got cash in the bank. And then one of Scott's questions is like, where do you live while all this is happening? Great question, because you might sell and have a 60 or 90 day settlement, you don't want to be rushed to buy either just because you've got a deadline to get out of your current home. So know your options, which is first one, long settlement for the sale because you've got nowhere to go yet and you can do earlier by mutual agreement and bring that settlement forward with no penalties. The other thing is understand the nature of the buyer who is buying your current property. If they're an investor, could you do a lease back option for a period of time where you settle but then rent the property back from them for a month by month or, you know, a short period of time? But then also potentially look at, and I know it's annoying to move twice. People don't like doing that. But for the sake of getting the right home, because usually when you're going from your first home to your upsizer, the upsize is like a 10 to 15 year plan. Like it's a long-term commitment. So short-term pain and potentially getting a short-term rental in the interim to give yourself some breathing space to go and find something you like and secure that property. That I find it interesting when buyers are pressured to buy based on a timeline, not based on what they like. You don't want to be in a rush to buy, in my opinion. You also don't want to wait too long in the market, but it's a balance.
Yeah. Logistically, look, you're going to go through it's a period in your life that's extremely important, isn't it? But we know that it's going to be over in a period of months, hopefully. Yeah. Right. So we've just got to grit our teeth and say, look, this is the process. Jot it down on paper if you need. These are the steps we need to take. These are the options we have for renting or moving in with friends or living in a caravan park or whatever's going to make it work for you and your life and your stress levels and your risk profile and everything else. But don't compromise the property that you're about to buy purely because you've backed yourself into a corner doing things around the wrong way.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm. So very wise advice, I think, overall.
And I think the other part of it is the emotion. It's like I've met people that have bought their owner-occ or their upsizer in a rush state because they just couldn't live with their parents any longer, right? It was just I'm urgent to go and get my own place. And they look back in 6 months, 12 months' time, it's like, hang on a minute. I, for the sake of another 3 months, did I pay too much for it? Did I buy the wrong property, et cetera, et cetera? So short-term pain, long-term gain would be the advice there as well.
Most definitely. I think that is balanced with the fact that, like, I do find it interesting when buyers spend a long time in the market. So sometimes there is such thing as looking for too long. The market can change month by month. At some point in the market, it was honestly week by week where, you know, the new norm became apparent. But yeah, it's a balance of not rushing, but also not dragging your feet because you could miss the boat on certain areas and certain stock types.
Yeah, I've got a client at the moment that I'm coaching and they're still looking for a property and they've been in the market for about a month and they've put in maybe six or seven offers and been unlucky on a couple of occasions. When I spoke to them last week, a little bit disgruntled with the process and started to take the blinkers off and say, yeah, maybe I just buy this house on the busy road So we just had to have a really good conversation around, okay, what's our strategy? The market's obviously moved a little bit. Are we putting in offers that are slightly too low? Like what's happening that's not giving us a result right now? So realize that, again, short-term sort of process to get that long-term benefit and don't compromise on what was your strategy to begin with.
Now, our next question comes from Melissa. And actually, Melissa has asked for your critique, John. So I'm going to read the question and let you have your opinion and I might chime in at the end. Melissa would love to hear John's critique on and provide his thoughts on a strategy that she's seen pop up recently with a company around a strategy that involves purchasing a property within the Brisbane area on 600 square metres of land or larger than with the intention of building a granny flat out the back. This particular strategy talks about they go deep into the numbers. They have like a YouTube channel, they talk about it. And Melissa's just not sure what to think of it. Obviously, Melissa trusts you, John, which is, so she should, to be honest.
That's nice. Thanks, Melissa.
Smarter Melissa. but yeah, and you know what? I know Melissa's talking about one particular company, but there are multiple companies, particularly, what is it with Brisbane and granny flats? Honestly, like granny flats are not a thing in Melbourne, or the strategy is not really a thing. Is it like, do people love having their grannies around? Like what's going on?
Well, there's a lot of suburbs in your great city that the land size is just too small, isn't it?
Like, yeah.
like try and put a granny flat in a house in Albert Park. It's not happening, is it? So I suppose your bigger blocks are obviously conducive to putting granny flats on. So the Brisbane's, the Adelaide's, the Perth's. We had a big change in New South Wales. Oh, it must have been like 10 years ago, where granny flats were conceptually approved on a state level, provided that you met some guidelines. So it almost overrode local council guidelines as well. So like things like a metre from the rear or the fence, the boundaries, I think it was like 5 metres from the existing dwelling, those sort of things. The appeal for it now, and thanks for your question, Melissa, and thanks for thinking that I'm trustworthy, that's great, is the cash flow, isn't it? Higher interest rates. Okay, we already own a property. It's maybe slightly negatively geared. It's impacting my lifestyle. I can put a $100,000 granny flat on it, and it can rent for $350 a week. There's a lack of dwellings for people to rent, so I know I'm going to get it rented straight away. That's the appeal, and obviously there's a lot of companies out there that are promoting that as their strategy for going and doing something. And as I say to everyone, when I come back to strategy, that's just one of them. We don't say, well, this is my strategy, now let's try and drape my personal situation around it. We've got to look at it from all angles. So definitely appealing, and definitely an attractive way to increase the cash flow. Generally speaking, we've got to be thinking, who are we selling it to in 8 to 10 years' time if it's an investment property? And I suppose what's changed, Emily, which makes it a little bit more appealing again, is the unaffordability of dwellings in a lot of capital cities. So I'll take the Central Coast, for example, because I live here and know it. A lot of people 20, 30 years ago were buying investment properties from Sydney, and they would use them as holiday homes from time to time, but they might rent them out as well, and they were bigger blocks, right? Fast forward to now, their sons, daughters, even grandkids now can't afford to buy in Sydney. So what are they doing? They're all moving up here. They're bringing their mums and dads, and they're building a granny flat out the back for mum and dad, who's now retired, and the siblings are living, or the sibling is living in the front house. So it's an affordability thing as well, to be able to make it an attractive offer to someone. So not only are we now selling owner ocs with granny flats to investors, which has not been the case normally previously because of the higher yields, but we could potentially sell them to owner ocs who say, right, mum and dad can live out the back, or my teenage son or daughter can live out the back. There's a lot more flexibility around it because of the unaffordability of real estate.
I'm curious to understand the types of people who are renting the renters of these granny flats. Because when I think about it logically, I'm like, yeah, granny flat makes sense in that when you have a family member, like almost like a studio out the back, right, for family that visit from interstate or whatever it might be, or as you touched on, people moving up to the coast and there's two dwellings on one plot of land for the family. But I think in my mind, with my renter hat on as a tenant, if let's say a granny flat was, I don't know, $350, $400 a week, and I don't actually really have my own address, but I could get a one-bedroom apartment in a similar area for the same sort of price, what would I choose? And then I guess on top of that, then my mind goes, well, why wouldn't you do a battle axe subdivision if you could, right, if the land allows it, to have actual two dwellings with two different addresses, because that's where the value is. The granny flat's just simply a dwelling. It's not a property on its own title. So that's, to me, where the money's really made. I understand the granny flat strategy. I just think there's a couple of considerations depending on the area of who it attracts, and as you touched on with resale, what that looks like. But the biggest thing that it speaks to, if people are considering granny flats as an option for a rental, we're in a severe housing crisis, right? Like, people are putting extra dwellings on the back of their property to house other people. That's because we don't have enough properties and we're having to maximise the land that we do have. So I think the crux of the situation comes down to the housing crisis, which is very evident at the moment.
It is. And that made me think of some good friends of mine that have just built their home and built it through COVID, and unfortunately had a lot of delays and setbacks. So their build costs went up quite considerably. And to mitigate that, they actually got approval to build a granny flat out the back to fund basically the running costs of their own mortgage. Right, so it's got separate entry. It hasn't got a car space. It's got separate entry. So, in some ways, you'd never know they're even there. But it's allowed them to continue to live in the area where they wanted to live and build because of the cash flow from the granny flat. So, yeah, there's some interesting strategies out there at the minute forced upon us because of the running costs of living, but also the affordability of houses.
Yeah, interesting. I'm curious to see where this granny flat thing goes over time.
Yeah, I personally think they're going to be more encouraged by local councils because there is just not enough dwellings, as you mentioned. The downside is the roads, the parks, the schools, because now we've got potentially double the people, but still the same roads and still the same parks, still the same schools. Yeah, like we had a school up the road that was bursting at the seams at 600, so they're basically knocking majority of it down and going two-storey to create 1,000 kids instead of 600, and that's happening everywhere around the country. So, yeah, it is. So there's merit to throw the toys out of the cot and go into Central Australia and get some space.
I guess the only other solution, right, is, and we've touched on this previously, but sprawl versus using what we have, right? Rather than making these satellite cities that are in greenfield estates, do we work with what we've got? And that's a great example of the school, like double level, same land but making it more usable and presumably a more affordable option than potentially creating another brand new school, you know?
Yeah, well, there's just no space to build the school because there's no more land, right? So that's the other issue of it all. But yeah, and there's this thing, and a lot of listeners, you may have heard of this, called NIMBYism, right? Not in my backyard. So local area.
I haven't heard that before.
Haven't you heard that? Yeah. So there's this whole group of NIMBYism happening in a lot of, not well-to-do necessarily, just good solid owner-occupier suburbs where the locals are saying, no, we don't want more houses. We don't want to get the roads busier. But council, on the other hand, is saying, well, yeah, we're divided because we know it's more stamp duty, it's more rates, it's more everything. But they can see the potential problems incurred with infrastructure issues down the track and, even just the sake of, well, we've got double more bins that need to be emptied on a Friday morning, for example. So, yeah, it's not going away anytime soon, this whole problem. But we sort of sidetracked a bit there, Melissa, but I think all relevant in general, it's just one strategy that needs to be entertained. And talking to someone on a clarity call in WA last week that was building a granny flat, but the granny flat costs were astounding, like talking almost $3,000 a square metre.
Oh.
And it was a high-end finish, obviously. But
did you want to hope so?
So I don't think you can build granny flats anymore for 80 to 100K. So even those costs have got to be factored in as increased.
We're going to take a quick break and come back with some more questions from the Facebook group. If this is your first time listening to This Is Property, go and check out the This Is Money Facebook group. That's where we get the questions from. So if you have a burning question, go and put it in there and put hashtag property and we will answer it in the coming episodes.
If you're after personal financial advice, don't get it from a podcast. If you would like help based on your own personal situation, head over to sortyourmoneyout.com. Click Get Help and we'd be happy to introduce you to one of our trusted advisors. We also have a panel of trusted mortgage brokers we can connect you with to get you into your first home, an investment property purchase, or to review your current loan if you don't have a broker. Our panel of advisors, mortgage brokers, and accountants work with clients all over Australia so they can connect with you wherever you are. That's sortyourmoneyout.com and click Get Help.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Now, John, we have a question, and the word termite makes me feel itchy. Like when I hear that word, it's like when someone says head lice, I'm like, ew, that's gross. Anyway, we're going to talk about termites, and Alex from the Facebook group has asked, while I was looking at the Section 32, which is a vendor statement in Victoria for a unit, I have noticed that a copy of the council's letter includes the following. It says, the council has designated the area to be subject to infestation of termites as described in Regulation 150. I've not seen this in a Section 32 before. Should this be something to be worried about? Great question, Alex. And look, John and I are not termite experts, but we've certainly come across our fair share of building and pest reports, which include the mention of termites. And they're very varied as to how severe they can be, depending on what part of Australia you're in as well.
Absolutely. Now, interesting stat, Emily, which you're probably aware of, but termites cause more damage to Australian homes than fire, floods and storms combined.
Oh, gosh. I actually didn't know that, but it does not shock me.
Yeah. So enter with caution, I suppose, when we're getting building and pest inspections done. And it's really when you see that we need to be asking questions. So case in point, I spoke to a building and pest inspector early this week who got a report back, and the client was actually a little bit concerned because it was a little bit vague, right? There was no termite damage as such, but it was vague as to whether there were termites there. He was almost alluding to the fact that there could be termites, right? And I rang him and said, what's the deal with this? You're sort of saying there is, but there isn't, and there's no damage. He said, look, to be honest, a large tree that's recently been chopped down in the backyard, I really wanted to scare your client, right, to the not in a bad way, but just to make them aware that we need to get termite inspections done. We need to put barriers up. We need to get regular checks on those barriers every 12 months, 2 years, whatever it might be. And if I didn't put it in there, it could have been neglected by the potential buyer, and 10 years' time, the house is riddled with termites. So, yeah, it was more of a precautionary thing in the pest inspection, which was quite interesting.
Honestly, I have seen it a lot where there's advice around termites, or there could be termite activity. And Alex's question refers, he's actually saying that the council has determined the area to be so that doesn't necessarily mean the property you're looking at in question has termites. Like, for example, if you're on the top floor of an apartment building with no timber, like, and you're in a double brick, you're probably not going to see it. Actually, though, for the first time ever, last week, I had a building and pest inspector do an inspection on a ground floor, double brick, 70s build apartment, and termite activity or evidence of past termite activity was found in the wardrobe.
Wow.
I couldn't believe it.
They found it. They didn't eat the concrete.
They
found the wood.
Yeah, they found the wood, and they always do. And it's kind of like, I liken it to the advice of clearing your gutters twice a year. The people who care about their homes do that. They book it in religiously. And you don't get, you know, water pooling, you don't have roof leaks or anything like that, no issues. Termite treatment is usually recommended every 12 months if there is timber that is susceptible to termite damage. Often timber decking is probably the most common one that I've seen in building and pest reports, but yes. Timber stumps under houses, which the best solution to that is change your stumps to concrete stumps, because they're easier long-term to maintain. You pack them rather than redo them, and I've had a lot of education around stumps over the years, John.
I've been schooled
a lot. but the general consensus, and I've used multiple building and pest inspectors over the years, and the general consensus is we live in Australia, we have termites.
Mm, absolutely. And more prevalent in, I suppose, areas that have got more trees. Right?
Yes.
It's just common sense that that's where they're going to hang about, like kid at a candy store, isn't it? That's the nice tasting food, and that's where I'm going to hang about. So they do eat from the ground up. So if you're finding termites in the roof, you've got big issues because they've eaten majority of your house, and it's lucky it's even still standing. So understand where that might be as well when you get the inspections. But if it's a major defect, termites, you're walking away every day of the week.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But, yeah, don't be alarmed by a lot of things in the contract. Just ask questions is probably the feedback there, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Do your homework. So we've had a bit of a double up in a question, John, that obviously is pressing that people want to know around capital gains tax and how you can be exempt from this, largely linked to the six-year rule that savvy property nerds will be aware of. But Paulina has asked, how many properties can be exempt from capital gains tax? If you move between your investment property and your prime place of residence, do you only ever get to claim the nil capital gain on one property in your portfolio? So let's just go back a step here. Paulina, we need to understand when a capital gains tax event would occur. So I think a lot of people would get confused around the fact that it actually happens when you sell the property. That's when you have a realized gain, is when you actually sell the property in that tax year, is when it would be apparent. And so trying to avoid capital gain, you can only have one property, which is your primary place of residence, that is exempt from capital gains tax. That's fundamentally, like, that's all you can do is have one.
Yes, provided that it's in your personal name.
Oh, yes, good point, John.
Mm. If it's not, there's no exemptions. Well, there may be exemptions, but like in the example of, let's say, trust, unit trust, you may have a 50% exemption, but that's the maximum that you could claim. So just make sure it is in your personal name for capital gains tax purposes in your own home that you're living in. People may ask, why would they put it not in your personal name for your principal place of residence? Well, I've seen it done. It is rare, but asset protection is probably one that comes to mind for a lot of people, especially if they're open to litigation given their profession.
Or it might have been originally an investment property that got turned into their primary place of residence too. Sometimes people buy ahead of the curve and, you know, yeah. So first things first, you can only have one property in your personal name that exempt from capital gains tax. And so combining that with Melissa's question around the six-year rule, because I think there's a fair bit of confusion when it comes to that about living in a property as your primary place of residence, moving out and changing it to an investment property, and moving out not to another property you've bought, but probably just to a rental, so you're not owning two properties because you can only nominate one as your PPR. And then there's a time frame that the government dictates, which is 6 years, in which you can move back into that original property, continue to live in it, and when you go to sell it, providing it's in your own name and you're currently residing in it, you would be exempt from capital gains tax when you go to sell it. It's all a little bit confusing. I kind of feel like we need a whiteboard.
Yeah. Well, you just need to think, Melissa, Paulina, you can only claim one as your principal place of residence for capital gains tax purposes. So, yeah, you can't try and do this shifty and have two properties that are totally exempt from capital gains tax. You choose your one. And the best way to bookmark that is to contact your accountant and say, look, I'm moving out. This is a date. Maybe get a valuation. This is what it's worth when I move out. Just if there is any questions down the track, you can be clear with essentially the ATO. They're the ones going to be chasing in the event of something that's hasn't gone their way.
The tax office, no one's best friend.
Although they keep the money, they keep the country running, don't they? With funds, supposedly.
Yeah, supposedly. I love that word, supposedly. Or allegedly, that's another good
allegedly.
One.
Allegedly. Yes, allegedly. All right, we got one more up our sleeve.
We do indeed. So our next question comes from Fonte asks, what are the downsides of pulling equity out for your primary place of residence and putting them into an offset? Is there any? Good question, Fonte. This question is probably more so directed towards a broker, but John is the next best thing to
ask. I'll make it up. Yeah. Well, I'm actually a qualified mortgage broker, should you know it, Emily.
Are you actually?
I am. Yes.
Really?
Yes. Never traded officially one day in my life as
how
a mortgage broker.
Know about this? Like, what are we? 4 years down the track.
Yes.
This is crazy.
Yeah. Well, you're safe, mortgage brokers. I'm not starting up a firm anytime soon. Although, never say never. Okay. What are the downsides of pulling equity out of your PPOR? Nothing, unless you use it for the wrong reason. So, when you pull out equity from your principal place of residence, let's be clear, it's paper value. It's not cash to say you now own it. You will pay interest on it as soon as you draw it down. So the logistics of it say, okay, my home's worth $800,000, my loan is $500,000. Let's say we want to pull out $100,000 of equity and go and use it. Now, we can use it essentially for whatever we want. We can go and buy a jet ski, we can buy a caravan, or we can buy an investment property, or we buy shares, or whatever we want, really. According to the ATO, in terms of tax deductions, they will say, well, if you're using it for income-producing purposes, i.e. Shares or investment properties or business, you can claim the running costs of that, i.e. the interest. But essentially, the $100K will come out and it'll sit in a new account, so it's a new loan. It can stay there for the next 100 years. You probably won't be here in that time, but let's say you kept it there for 5 years and didn't draw $1 down from it. You would not be charged any interest. And provided there's no fees on that account, you'd not be charged anything. As soon as you draw it down, that's when the interest starts to kick in. So the downsides of pulling equity out is that you need to repay that loan back, but you're using it as, it's not free money, but you haven't really gone and earned that money, have you? It's come about as a result of you improving the asset, or the asset's just grown in value because you bought well, and you can take it and use it for deposits and costs on your on an investment property, right? You'll still need a loan over and above that for the remainder of the purchase, but essentially that's how the equity works. People might be freaked out in doing that for the first time because they're like, hang on a minute, I've worked really hard to pay down my principal place of residence debt. Now you're telling me I want to increase it again to buy an investment property. So we sit down and say, well, okay, what are the other options? Do I want to use my cash? No, because the cash is there to pay down our mortgage to begin with. And this debt coming out, if we're using it for an investment property, not a jet ski or a caravan, it's tax deductible. So we refer to that as good debt as opposed to our mortgage on our own home, which is bad debt.
There's often a misconception that equity is like free money.
Yeah, cash.
It's like, oh, it's just money that I have. No, you pay for it.
Yeah, you pay for it, absolutely. And the interest rates are sometimes a little bit higher than our principal place of residence debt, but not too much. I think we had Rach on the show from Sphere Home Loans a few weeks ago, and she was sort of saying around about 0.2% was quite normal now, which is not much, is it, Emily? Like, you talk about maybe 6% on your own rock and 6.2% as an investment, depending on whether you're going in at 90% or 80% or whether it's interest only or P&I, of course, but yeah, that's not too bad at all.
I think the important part is not to be over-leveraged as well. That's the biggest thing. I often ponder the valuations that come in for properties, right? Because your equity is only as good as the valuation that comes in from the bank. And if you get, you know, a couple of different banks. What did I heard a snippet, you must have been on Instagram, John. I heard about... Oh,
I was just about to bring that up.
Yes, yeah, so like, I was like, why did I hear that? And it wasn't on the podcast because I wasn't listening to our podcast.
Yeah,
but yes, Instagram, you said about someone who got two different valuations.
Yes, I'm impressed that you're listening to my lowly social life on Instagram.
Oh, John, don't be ridiculous.
But
I see your post, I listen to you.
So yeah, three valuations, you're right. And it was a client of ours that went back 18 months later on their investment, and we said, let's go and get three vals, as good brokers will recommend anyway. And there was I think it was 150K difference between the lowest val and the highest val. And we're talking a property that's like, they pay for it $397, I believe. So yeah, we're talking like 500-600K properties. Like, that's unbelievable that you've got such a variance. So, and devil's advocate would say, well, if I take the higher val, am I getting myself into a negative equity position?
That's what I was thinking.
So the val come in at, let's say, 650. So, but we know that it's probably only worth 600. But I get to take 40 grand or 30 grand or 50 grand or 80 grand more equity out to go and buy another investment property. It might be the difference between me buying an investment property or not now. Yeah, so you've got to have the right risk profile, I suppose, when it comes to that. And yes, you may be on paper in a negative equity position, but the bank's not going to come knocking on your door to say, oh, gee, we've revalued it 6 months later and you're actually in negative equity, so we're going to force you to pay down 100 grand. That doesn't happen in residential real estate unless you stop making payments.
Yeah.
Mm. So, yeah, it's all about the pros and cons. But, yeah, the valuation's an interesting one.
Always. And you're always going to get variance. I don't think three vals ever come in exactly the same figure. So, well, I think that's it for today.
All right, lots of different topics. Hopefully, as a listener, you got some value out of that. We enjoy answering these questions because they're never the same and we cannot make them up. So, yeah, if you've got any questions that you want to ask, feel free to send a DM to Emily or put it in the Facebook group.
Put it in the Facebook group. I've got 123 message requests on my TikTok that I haven't read. So if that tells you anything, John, I cannot manage my social media inboxes, email or put in the group.
My 14-year-old was proud to tell me 2 days ago that he's got more followers on his TikTok account than me. So
there you go.
He's, yeah.
Dickity talk.
Yeah. very good. All right, peoples. Thank you once again. Until next time, happy investing.
We acknowledge the traditional custodians of the lands on which we live and work and pay respects to their elders past, present and emerging. We extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who may listen to this podcast. It's time to get the property you want. If buying your first home or investing in property is something you're interested in, check out John Pidgeon's book, Sort Your Property Out and Build Your Future. John covers the essentials like how to find hotspots and notspots, due diligence, mortgages, tax stuff, grants and schemes, and how to set up your investing timeline. It's the only book you'll need about buying and investing in property. Visit sortyourpropertyout.com to grab your copy. This podcast is for education and entertainment purposes. Any advice is general financial advice only, which does not take into account your objectives, financial situation, or needs. Because of that, you should consider if the advice is appropriate to you and your needs before acting on the information. If you do choose to buy a financial product, read the product disclosure statement, target market determination, and obtain appropriate financial advice tailored to your needs. Simo Interactive Proprietary Limited, the publisher of the podcast, and Glenn James are authorised representatives of Money Sherpa Proprietary Limited, which holds financial services license 451289.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.